beginning in the early spring of 2006, due to an intercepted letter sent by a Bloods leader named Lester Alford. In the letter, Alford had stated that over a dozen weapons had been stashed in four prisons, including New Jersey State, formerly Trenton State, and a coordinated uprising was planned that would culminate in the assassination of Mayor-elect Cory Booker. While the authorities checked into the validity of the letter, most believed it to be dubious, since the language was not coded the way most gang correspondence was. All inmate release programs, furloughs, conjugal visits, work release, and medical, were suspended indefinitely. All Rob could do was visit the prison as often as possible and look through the plexiglass at his father, a man who had always been broad and thick like his son, and had become more so through 16 years of weightlifting in the prison yard, and now began to waste away as if some invisible spirit were penetrating the prison walls each night to peel away layers from both his mind and his body. Friar Leahy sensed the turbulence. Rob was perhaps more adept now than he'd been even in high school at concealing whatever struggles he was going through. He went through his days, as he always had, giving lectures on simple cell structure, bringing the hammer down on sassy students, teaching the geometry of shot angles in the pool. Friar Leahy knew about Rob's father, as Rob had formally asked permission to leave school early once or twice a week to get down to Trenton before visiting hours ended. But whatever weighed on him now was heavier even than Skeet's declining health. Whether his father's illness precipitated a larger existential question of what he was supposed to be doing, or whether the two existed on wholly separate planes of consciousness, Friar Leahy didn't know. What he did know, what Coach Ridley had known during their first conversation about becoming a teacher, was that Rob was not destined to work at a high school. He also knew that Rob Peace was strong enough, resilient enough, and smart enough to figure out what he was destined to do. At least he hoped that to be the case, because he knew that Rob would neither ask for counsel nor receive it if given. The water polo team was not strong, but they still traveled to tournaments every weekend. He and Coach Ridley would take turns driving the vans. When Rob wasn't driving, he sat in the back with players such as Truman Fox. Truman was a quiet kid, white with blonde hair, relatively affluent. He was also lazy, one of those who tiptoed along the bottom during laps and found creative ways to dip out of the weight room. Rob, Coach Peace, to Truman, singled him out, though not as harshly as some of the others. He treated the boy almost like a science project. "Why are you here?" Rob asked. "Because we have to play a sport. It's required," Truman replied. "Okay, so play it. Don't just fuck around." "I'm not fucking around." "You're not making it hard." Truman didn't know what that meant. "If you go into something, you'd better make it hard, otherwise what's the point?" Truman still found his words elusive yet intimidating. Rob was wearing one of his dark glowers, signaling exasperation. "Look, anything you do, if it isn't hard, it isn't doing anything for you, so you're better off not doing it. Use your time somewhere else." That Saturday, when Rob opened up the weight room for a voluntary session, Truman was there. After that, their van ride conversations strayed away from the sport of water polo and the reasons for playing it. Rob would look out the window at the dense foliage sweeping past on the interstates of New England and Pennsylvania, and he'd ask Truman about his family, his upbringing, what he wanted to be when he grew up. He talked about what he believed to find a real man, someone who had honor, curiosity, respect for women, and took responsibility for his people. The talk was real, and Truman remained surprised that Rob was willing to engage with him this way, being as they'd come from such different backgrounds. Not apparent in these moments was the hard, glaring facade Rob often brought to the classroom and the pool. He looked soft, even gentle. The fact that Coach Peace went out of his way to be friends with him was powerful, and Truman held on to that power tightly, both at school and at home. He felt that if Rob saw a spark in him, even if Truman himself did not, then it was his own responsibility to stoke it. Truman would ultimately play water polo in college. He didn't know that on a normal day after practice, while he and his teammates were changing back into dry clothes, his coach was mentally preparing to spend the night selling drugs. Procuring enough marijuana to distribute was not difficult, but procuring quality marijuana was. At Yale, the quality had barely mattered. College kids would smoke anything, and most of them didn't know the difference. In the city, although many drug users would smoke anything, they had more options and less disposable wealth. To remain the go-to guy in his small network of buyers, Rob had to be available when the calls came, and he had to provide a product that was reliable in the high it engendered. There were two primary types of high: body stone, also known as couch lock. The typical effect of smoking the indica strain of the cannabis plant was characterized by a very intense lethargy, a difficulty with an indifference to practical tasks, and a desire for a meditative solitude. Head high from the sativa strain was more energetic, typified by stone people talking and laughing with enhanced visual and auditory senses, prone to psychedelic experiences and sometimes bouts of paranoia. Rob wasn't particularly fond of either. When stoned, he preferred to be somewhere in between, able to accomplish tasks and operate in the world, but to do so in an unbothered state, free from the gravity pulling him in all directions. As he struggled with his mother's needs and his father's illness and his own stasis, he sought to engineer the high that suited him. In the basement of 34 Smith Street, where Curtis lived alone now, Rob invented his own personal strain of marijuana, an indica sativa hybrid known widely as Sour Diesel. The Burger Boys had once packed themselves into this space to do their homework over sodas and Mrs. Gamble's cooking. Now, Rob spent nights there alone constructing a hydroponic system of planters beneath LED lights, which consumed more than 3/4 of the floor space. His parent plants were sent from the Emerald Triangle in California, heavily wrapped in dozens of layers of cellophane to contain the scent, then packaged in kitchen appliance boxes, toasters, blenders, microwaves, appearing as an eBay purchase. Patiently, through the same process of trial and error that had defined his years in the lab, he used simple biology to fuse various genotypes in the seedling stage, and over the course of months, in early 2006, he perfected his strain. The basement wasn't big enough for mass production, but it spawned sufficient product to cut his Sour Diesel with the less particular buds he bought from his connects. To intensify the high and raise profits, he used the low boiling point of butane to distill hash oil from the typically discarded stalks and leaves, which he then dripped into the smokable buds. This work was repetitive, laborious, and dangerous, not just because of the police patrolling the neighborhood, but also because butane fumes are poisonous, and he had to wear a gas mask while he worked. But during the winter of 2006, this was how Rob spent the bulk of his free time, alone in the basement making designer marijuana. Why? Again and again, his friends asked him this question with humor more often than not. At the time, Rob's day-to-day seemed like a sitcom to them. Yale grad high school teacher running a marijuana lab out of his best friend's basement in Illtown. Rob would just shrug and give one of his that's-my-own-damn-business looks, and his friends would answer their own question. He needed the money, and this was something he knew how to do. But over time, as his fatigue grew, the energy suction of tending to his students at school and his family at home, paired with the stress of operating an illegal enterprise in a gang-dominated area, plus barely sleeping in general, they began to see that Rob's condition went deeper. In that basement, Rob felt in control. He had created something, and his work was bringing in money. And that dynamic gave him pride. He found a lawyer in Toms River who, after reviewing the vast history of documents Rob organized, visiting Skeet and naming a retainer that Rob could afford after a winter of intensive drug dealing, agreed to file one last appeal. In place of courtroom hearings, the argument consisted of a 6-page brief, written and filed with a much larger compilation of supporting documents, asserting that Skeet's post-conviction relief had been overturned by an improper standard of review. Skeet was living in the prison infirmary, weak and heavily sedated. The prison medical ward didn't stock much in the way of cancer treatments, but it had plenty of pain medication. For the first time since Skeet's reprieve during Rob's senior year of high school, Rob is able to visit without the plexiglass between them, to look into his father's eyes without a coating of dust, to breathe the same air while they spoke without telephone receivers, to hold his father's hand. The summer was hot and muggy, despite the air conditioning, which was one of the few benefits of living in the infirmary. Rob made no effort to travel that summer. He had been coming to the prison up to 5 times a week, though rarely with anything to report about the appeal. The forms had been filed. The state had countered. The judge was reviewing. They both knew that, however the appeal turned out, Skeet did not have long to live. Brain cancer, in comparison with other terminal forms that impacted bones or vital organs, usually involved less physical pain. His tumor had not ravaged his body aside from the dramatic weight loss, and steroid treatments had helped alleviate that effect. The building pressure within his skull caused intense headaches and nausea, but another regimen of drugs eased the physical sickness to a manageable degree. His face appeared increasingly swollen, a symptom Skeet seemed to bear well. Mostly, he was just very, very drowsy, and the intensity of his fatigue began to mark his life's inexorable waning. His mental faculties flickered on and off. Some visits he would exhibit that old charismatic ferocity, while others he was impossibly far away and mouthing inaudible words known only to him. On those days, Rob would sit silently beside him for the entirety of their time. That Skeet's illness decayed his mind over his body might have been a comfort to Rob. He might have witnessed or projected some semblance of well-being onto his dying father that manifested mostly in long periods of sleep. Just as likely, Rob might have taken a vicious offense at this last cruel turn in his father's fate. Very few people in Rob's life had cherished their brains more than Skeet, and that was precisely where the disease had fortified itself. Meanwhile, up and down the ward, prisoners lay in cots separated by yellowed curtains, their existence announced by the steady chorus of complaints regarding their various discomforts, mostly due to infectious diseases and the deficiency of their treatments. On August 16, 2006, Rob learned that the final appeal had been denied. The judge decided that the district court applied the correct standard of review in determining that the appellate division's decision was not contrary to or did not involve an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law as determined by the Supreme Court of the United States. On August 22nd, Skeet slipped into an unconscious state, the final event for most patients with his condition. Some took days or even weeks to pass away. But Skeet's respiratory system failed that same night, and he asphyxiated quietly, alone in his sleep, a month shy of his 60th birthday. Rob handled the funeral arrangements. Very few people attended the service in East Orange. Skeet's old friends in the neighborhood still told stories about him, but not many had stayed in touch with the hero of these stories. Almost no one in Rob's life even knew what had happened. In Rosedale Cemetery, less than 2 miles northeast of Chapman Street, he stood with Jackie at the foot of the plot while the coffin went down. His head was bowed and his body provided a column against which his mother could lean as her mind revisited the decisions that were now being laid to rest along with Skeet Douglas's body. They each dropped a lily into the grave and they left as the dirt was being packed in. Rob didn't buy a tombstone. Like Skeet's legal options throughout the 19 years that had passed since his arrest, a proper stone was too expensive, and an affordable stone wouldn't do the job required. The plot was marked by a thin strip of brown concrete with a metallic disc bearing the number 54, and a small depression in the ground, 6 inches deep and 9 in diameter, an earthen flower receptacle. Later that day, Rob and Victor went to Orange Park to smoke, a cathartic ritual dating back to Mount Carmel. Rob said, "I lost my father 3 times, first when he went to jail, second when he went back to jail, and now he's in the ground." Rob looked up and turned his head toward his oldest friend. "Thank you." "For what?" "Coming to the funeral means a lot." Unlike the moment in this same spot 8 years ago when they were talking about the uncertainty of college, or the moment shortly after that when Mr. Cawley gave Rob the paper napkin that removed the uncertainty, he did not cry. He'd never failed a test before, and he was pissed. The questions they asked, it was like the most obscure shit imaginable, he told Tavares, who considered that listening to Rob Peace bitch about an exam was one of the least likely scenarios he could ever have imagined. "Go back, take it again," Tavares replied. "I don't have time for this shit," Rob yelled, activated despite the setback. Peace Realty, the new goal coalesced in the wake of Skeet's passing as the 06-07 school year began. After 2+ years of home ownership, he'd finally renovated the house on Greenwood to a decent state. By living with Jackie on Chapman and renting out all 3 units on Greenwood, he was actually turning a profit of $1,000 a month, though that number fluctuated depending on repairs. The process of making Greenwood work had been clumsy, protracted, and too much hassle for what he earned. In some ways, the clumsiness was what compelled Rob to become more involved in the real estate market, as trial and error more often than not led to success. And he wanted very badly to be successful in real estate. Whereas the relative success of teaching was almost abstract in that it was contained within those most self-contained of creatures, teenage boys, he saw something pleasantly simple about the real estate cycle. locate an undervalued property, buy it, and renovate, find the right homeowner, and come away with $20,000 or $30,000 cash in pocket. Success in real estate required skills that Rob believed were some of his strongest. The work ethic to locate those homes, the social skills to negotiate with people ranging from rich lenders to working-class contractors to poor renters, and the desire to make money in crafty but fundamentally honest ways. And at least in Rob's idealized vision, he would be making a positive mark in the world, because a house meant shelter, it meant heat, it meant security. Above all, it meant family. Some friends who knew about Skeet's passing felt that something equally powerful drove him. Rob had lost not only his father, but also the goal of releasing his father, in which he'd invested so much work since high school. He'd achieved almost every objective he'd ever laid out for himself. Swimming, college, Rio. But this one, probably his most valued, had beaten him. As he laid out this new goal for himself, those around him saw emotional progress and perhaps recovery. He knew from his high school stint working in title research that many people who pursued profits in real estate did so in less than intelligent ways, due either to ignorance, dishonesty, or the pressure of time. Rob desired to be neither ignorant nor dishonest, and he didn't plan on rushing. But before he could do anything, he needed to pass the realtor's exam. While flipping houses did not require a realtor's license, he wanted one in order to access the multiple listing service that contained the most up-to-date information on current properties. Without that access, he would be working from behind the competition. He passed the exam on his third attempt in January 2007, and he partied the entire weekend with the energy that had characterized graduation weekend at Yale. The malaise that had gripped him for the past 2 years seemed to have lifted. The man drinking vodka shots and cracking jokes and rallying for a trip to the strip club resembled the kid the Burger Boys had known in high school, the kid who had carried them all. From beneath the festivities arose a new determination, an orderly alignment of the future he now envisioned. He would finish out this school year, his fourth. He would continue living on Chapman Street and hustling at night. He would save money with the same frugality and vigor he had since he was a kid. At year's end, he would start investing that money in houses, beginning with 3 or 4 inexpensive urban properties similar to Greenwood, the cumulative rent of which would theoretically provide him with an income of roughly $3,000 to $4,000 per month, in addition to his drug earnings, which he planned to ramp down on the same time frame. Once fixed up, he would flip all the houses except for Greenwood and come out with $100,000 to $150,000 profit. Half of this he would invest in more real estate. The other half he would use to support Jackie and begin graduate school. As soon as the math worked out, he would stop selling drugs completely. At least, this was how the next few years coalesced in his mind. He went through this itemized list with Curtis and Tavris over and over. Curtis's stepfather was an accountant, and he would help with the incorporation of a company. Not technically necessary, but useful in terms of credibility. Oswaldo was in medical school at Penn, but his father was around to work on renovations at a low rate. Tavris would perform all the title research. Wherever a connection could be made to family or friends, Rob made it. As he wrote and rewrote the hard numerical figures in a composition notebook, his handwriting, as ever, impeccable and slightly effeminate, he drew the vision further and further outward into the future, where his thinking became less analytical, increasingly idealized. Once Peace Realty had built up a reputation for savvy and efficiency, he would move into the commercial market, buy vacant storefronts along South Orange Avenue, and install real businesses, the kind that represented a neighborhood in ascendance rather than stasis or decline. Delis and coffee shops and clothing stores instead of funeral homes and weave salons and check cashing centers. The capital for such an undertaking would come from white men in suits who worked downtown, knew the mayor personally, believed in revitalization, and respected someone like Rob who had the education and street-level knowledge to accomplish it. Night after night that fall, as the weather drove backyard barbecues at 34 Smith Street inside for round-table conversations in the kitchen, the Burger Boys talked about what they would achieve. They didn't reference the luck that seemed vital to anyone in East Orange raising his station. They'd each run through enough bad luck for 50 young men, and their optimism was total, driven by the fact that Rob was operating at their center once again. Friar Leahy in the offices and hallways of St. Benedict's saw something different. He saw a man who was burnt out, a man who was conflicted, a man who was refusing to come to terms with the loss of a father. Rob had never spoken much, neither in unknown sons' gatherings nor faculty meetings. but he'd always listened, had always processed the obligations of being a schoolteacher quietly, studiously. He'd always put forth the effort required to perform his job well. At the end of the 05-06 school year, the students had given him the Teacher of the Year Award. Not so as the 06-07 school year wore on, when called on to speak up on matters ranging from the annual budget to cutlery being stolen from the cafeteria, he'd come out of his thoughts reluctantly and say, "What? Sorry." Zoned out. Sometimes there would be contempt in his voice akin to a disengaged teenager being called out in the classroom, a note of, "Tell me why this is worth my time?" During classes, his patience and air of peership frayed. A typical confrontation with a student who'd cracked a joke during Rob's lecture had ascended into an uncontrolled shouting match, as was custom now, the parents complained, and Rob was called in for another reluctant apology. During practices and tournaments, he let kids slack off as if lacking the energy to dog them. In the context of this high school in this city, disengagement was always the first sign of problems at home. Friar Leahy sensed that the former presidential award winner's tenure as a schoolteacher was reaching its natural end. In keeping with the school's method of dealing with its students' personal lives, he did not confront Rob directly about any particular problems he might have been having. Instead, in the winter of 2007, he mentioned the Appalachian Trail hike coming up in the summer, which Rob had helped lead for the last 3 years. "I'm just thinking ahead and wanted to make sure you were on board this year." Rob looked away toward a state championship soccer trophy in Leahy's office. "I might be traveling this summer," Rob said. "Where to?" "Hopefully Rio, but also Ohio to see family." "Okay, that's totally fine," Friar Leahy replied. "The boys will miss having you." "Yeah," Rob said. "And also, I'm thinking about graduate school for chemistry. I'm thinking about doing that next year." "I think that's a very wise move," Leahy said without hesitation. "So you want to keep teaching on the next level?" Rob shrugged. "Maybe. Right now, just starting to think about the applications. Anything I can do to help you, tell me. Got it?" "Thanks, Father Ann." On July 1st, 2006, Cory Booker officially took office as the new mayor of Newark. He'd gained fame in the late 90s as a city councilman who would sleep in a tent at city housing projects, hold hunger strikes and live on food stamps, patrol bad neighborhoods himself, and physically confront the dealers holding down their corners. His victory was the first regime change in 2 decades, and it happened only after 6 years of near-bloody battling between the young, charismatic, light-skinned, Stanford-Yale-Oxford-educated upstart and the old, grizzled, but equally charismatic incumbent. The tension between Cory Booker and Sharp James had been national news for most of the 2000s. The 2002 election, which Booker lost, was documented in the Oscar-nominated Street Fight, which between talking head interviews showed intense footage of the predominantly poor black constituents who ardently supported James's altercating with the working-class whites and Puerto Ricans who fought for Booker and his eloquent calls for public service and revitalization. The documentary was a near-perfect picture of a specific place and time, the declining city at risk of being left behind, the shoulder-height view of the vast number of problems in play, and the presentation of 2 equal and opposing paths forward, whose backers were split almost definitively along socioeconomic lines. The 2002 election had been beyond combative. A riot nearly broke out when Booker showed up at a street basketball tournament that Sharp James was already attending, and James called Booker a Republican who took money from the KKK and the Taliban, who's collaborating with the Jews to take over Newark. When James, who was constantly being investigated for various alleged corruptions, won the election by a margin of 53% to 47%, his victory seemed to cement Newark's representation of permanent poverty, a culture of violence and corruption, at least if you subscribed to the New York Times. Mayor James pulled out of the 2006 election and anointed the deputy mayor, Ronald Rice, as his successor. Booker, backed by the majority of corporate interests in the city, outspent Rice 25-1 and won the election with 72% of the vote. 2 years later, Sharp James was convicted on 5 counts of fraud for conspiring to rig the sale of 9 city lots to his mistress, who quickly resold them for hundreds of thousands of dollars in profit. The new mayor's campaign pledge to beef up the police department in order to make Newark the national leader in crime reduction was what inspired the Bloods assassination attempt, which in turn had denied Skeet Douglas the possibility of external cancer treatment. Booker came into office with an ambitious 100-day plan to increase police forces and background checks for many city jobs so that former offenders could find employment, improve city services, and expand summer youth programs. Though Newark city government did not extend to the Oranges, his rise suggested a shift in the direction of the city. Even those who had voted for the other guy were curious and perhaps even hopeful about what the future might bring. "That's your boy," Rob's friends would say, messing with him. "Went to Yale and everything." Even in this context, Rob was uncomfortable being associated with Yale, let alone the charming, some might say slick politician who hadn't even grown up in Newark himself. "We'll see what he does," Rob said. "He's been talking a long time. Let's see how he does now that he's in it for real." And his expression said resignedly, "I don't have high hopes. Now, let's talk about something that matters." "Yo, get up here." Rob is in the basement at Smith Street around midnight, gas mask on, filtering hash oil through the tiny perforations at the end of his sieve. Around him, the hydroponic planters formed three sides of a rectangle. The auto-timed LED lights above the sprouting plants blasted white light, screwing up Rob's internal clock even more than his odd hours already had. He went upstairs, where Curtis and Tavris were peering out the front window. "Booby's back," Curtis said with rare concern. Rob looked casually through the crack of the curtain. A sedan was parked directly in front of the house, engine idling. A glowing ember was visible through the windows being passed among multiple silhouettes. "Yeah," Rob said, "that's his ride." He'd been hearing noise from his connects that Booby, a forceful member of the Double I sets, had a beef with Rob, because by now word had slipped that his sour diesel was off the hook, meaning something so new and fresh that it could be taken straight off the hangar at a clothing store. Word had also gotten out that Rob had been dealing to some of Booby's people. He wasn't poaching clients, he'd just become the guy they called if Booby couldn't be reached. Generally, this was not considered encroachment. "That stupid motherfucker," Rob said, seeming more exasperated than afraid. "Should we call the police?" Curtis asked. "Are you crazy?" Rob replied as he gestured with his eyes to the basement below. "Let's just head out the back," Tavris said. The house occupied a double lot with a rear driveway that exited onto Telford Street, one block east of Smith. "Head to Flowey's. They probably have a car on Telford, too." Rob sighed and put on his old leather jacket. "I'll go take care of it. I mean, these fucking stupid people, I just can't stand stupid people." Before his friends could stop him, Rob was outside knocking on the driver's side window of the car. The window lowered halfway. Curtis and Tavris watched. The street was deserted. Rob was bent over, his head just outside the opening in the window. His hands made wide gestures on either side of his body. The head inside the car, presumably Booby's, was shaking from side to side, then nodding up and down. They heard garbled voices. Rob's remained genial. Then Booby laughed. The window lowered all the way, and Booby's arm extended toward Rob. The only reason Curtis and Tavris knew there was not a loaded gun fixed to the end of that arm was that Rob took it in his own, forearms forming an inverted V with the hands locked at the thumbs. Their other hands gripped one another's shoulders. Rob took a hit from the joint inside the car, and the vehicle pulled out as he turned back to the house. "Damn, it's freezing out," he muttered when he came inside. "What was that?" Curtis asked. "It's all good," Rob said. He strolled back through the kitchen and made himself a screwdriver from the 1.5-liter bottle of Smirnoff on top of the refrigerator. Then he grabbed the gas mask, put it on, and went back downstairs. The following spring was his last at St. Benedict's, and the feeling was similar to that which had marked our final semester in college, a mixture of nostalgia for the past and excitement about the future, as he performed the tasks he'd performed each day for 4 years, tasks he would never perform again. He went on his last water polo tournament weekend and stayed up in the motel room he shared with Coach Ridley, watching action movies and putting off the moment when one of them had to check on the players' rooms. He taught his last classes on Darwinian evolution, recessive genes, and cellular structures of plants. He sat through his last faculty meetings and pulled his last students aside in the hallways to drill the importance of discipline. He attended his last senior banquet, listened to the last presidential award winner give a speech to parents, teachers, and guests. As in most years, Charles Cawley was one of those guests. Rob had seen Mr. Cawley a few times during his teaching career, usually at homecoming and the senior banquet. They had always made a point of speaking with one another. But these had been increasingly distant, at points awkward, conversations as Rob had become more and more aloof. After the speech at the 2007 banquet, Mr. Cawley approached Rob's table, as he had done Rob's senior year 9 years earlier. Rob stood up, shook his hand, and said, "Hey, Mr. Cawley, how's it going?" "How's it going with you?" Mr. Cawley replied. "Getting by?" "Friar Ed told me that your father passed. I'm sorry." "Thank you, sir." "And I understand you're leaving the school?"
"Yes."
"And what are your plans?"
"Grad school."
"Oh, which one? I'm curious."
"Not sure yet. Still working on it."
Mr. Cawley looked into Rob's eyes and understood that the young man was saying this only because he was supposed to. He saw something more in those eyes. Anger. The emotion wasn't nakedly apparent, but Mr. Cawley was a professional at reading the subtleties of people. The elderly and wildly successful credit card magnate believed that certain human frailties could actually help fuel success. Insecurity drove billionaire entrepreneurs. Emotional instability made for superb art. The need for attention built great political leaders. But anger, in his experience, led only to inertia. He remembered when he'd offered to pay Rob's tuition at this very event, in this very gymnasium, an offer he'd never made to any student before or since. As a financial master, Mr. Cawley looked at the world in terms of investments, of risk and reward. In 1998, the investment in Rob had struck him on paper as one of the lowest risk and the highest return. He saw no possible downside in giving this rare boy the slight push, Yale's 4-year tuition of $140,000 being slight for a bank CEO worth 9 figures. He needed to reach the pinnacle for which he was already headed. Almost a decade later, as Rob broke off eye contact to gaze down at the floor as if there were a pit between them, Mr. Cawley understood that a life wasn't lived on paper. He was not disappointed so much as confused, and he opted not to inquire further into what exactly had happened to Rob's psyche between Yale graduation and now. He wanted to spare himself the sting of his own poor judgment. This conversation was the last he ever had with Rob. The fact was that Rob hadn't filled out any grad school applications. He'd been too busy over the last few months poring over real estate information, and all the study had led him to the conclusion that Newark and the Oranges were not the places to invest in property right now. Cory Booker's ambitions, predictably, were expensive, and the mayor had already installed an 8.3% hike on property taxes to help pay for them, the largest such increase in the city's history. From his experience managing the Greenwood property, he knew that finding tenants with the credit to make security deposits was hard enough, and extracting rent from them on time was harder still. Even so, the average property value remained in the high 5 figures to low 6s, inflated by their proximity to so many well-off neighborhoods just beyond. Profit margins were thin, and effort expenditure was high. Lenders were hard to deal with, suspicious, and often crooked. Jackie had been right. Buying property in the neighborhood where he'd grown up was a bad idea. So he looked elsewhere, and he landed on Ohio. A few of his aunts and uncles lived in and around Cleveland. Rob had visited many times, and he'd seen an opportunity. Modest houses on decent plots in diverse working-class neighborhoods, where the economy was driven by historically stable manufacturing companies. Newark had been just like that once, before Rob's time. He'd been making weekend trips to the area to do title research in the records offices, making connections among the lending community and prospect houses in person. Home values in many of these exurb communities fell as low as the mid-5 figures. The people who wanted to live there tended to have stable jobs and families. Money was still easy enough to come by. As a starting point for Peace Realty, the location made sense. But all the traveling had been expensive, and would become more so once he actually established a presence. Rob was naturally frugal. He always had been. He hated paying $300 for a 90-minute flight, hated renting cars, hated paying more than $100 a night for dingy hotel rooms. Above all, he hated the fact that 9 months after having established Peace Realty as his next career move, he hadn't actually accomplished anything, and so he would need a paying job to float him in the interim between leaving St. Benedict's and profiting off his first group of properties. Rob did end up going on the Appalachian Trail hike early that summer. He took the position in the back of the line to prod the stragglers. He helped with tent setup, cooked beans and rice over campfires, and led circular conversations about goal setting as the logs broke down. Mostly he walked alone through the quiet forest, appearing pensive and often unapproachable. The hike itself was uneventful, one of the easiest they'd ever had. When the bus picked them up at the Delaware Water Gap, Rob was given a send-off in the form of an ovation and a school t-shirt. An hour later, the group disembarked on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in downtown Newark, filthy and weary, and the students scattered toward their parents' waiting cars, and the teachers went to the parking garage to head home to their families. Rob lingered in and around the school for a few more hours. He went to the science offices to make sure his stuff was all cleared out. He went to the pool to check his coach's locker and take a shower after 10 days on the trail. Then he went almost immediately to his new job at the Newark International Airport. Part 5. Baggage. Chapter 12. The skin of his face and forearms had darkened to an inky hue. The sun bore down directly overhead, its heat absorbed by the asphalt underfoot to the point where the rubber soles of his work boots softened and began adhering to the ground. At its peak, the temperature on the tarmac could reach upward of 120 degrees, and the heat became locked between the blacktop and the haze of thick exhaust fumes firing out of the jet engines as they endlessly jockeyed around him. Rob's bright orange vest called to mind his father's prison uniform during those first 3 years at Essex County. During the most heavily trafficked hours, he wore noise-canceling earmuffs, but he preferred not to. In the tall windows of the terminal one story above, he could see the travelers waiting for their planes, listening to music or pecking on laptops, young children with faces pressed against the glass in awe of the massive vehicles that would carry them into the sky. Below the terminal, on ground level, Rob hefted their distended suitcases, their golf clubs and strollers and duffels into the cargo hold. "Yo, Peace. What's up, Peace? Need you over here, Peace?" His co-workers were almost all men, typically broad men with hoarse voices, who had been doing this work a long time. They had their systems and their silent language. They knew how to move the bags fast enough to satisfy the gate attendants upstairs, but slowly enough so as not to faint from exhaustion. A careful efficiency governed their work, a weighing of the most important commodity in the airport, time against the most important commodity of the laborers, stamina. Rob fit in seamlessly, almost anonymously. He didn't complain, in fact, he rarely spoke at all on the job. During breaks, he typically read alone in the employee lounge, or took a cigarette to the subterranean parking lot outside the terminal set aside for staff smokers. While working, he was strong and tireless, not susceptible to the general stress that trickled down from the dispatchers, constantly barking from the control tower. Most people rattled easily at first due to the unceasing chorus of, "Hurry it up, hurry it up, hurry it the fuck up!" Others became mean and irritable. Peace, which was the name by which he was known, struck others as being very chill. He was simply there, on time, making sure the work got done, but never putting his personality forward beyond the work. He was the kind of guy you wanted in this arena, especially in the heat of the 2007 summer. Muggy, stagnant, unrelenting. "You didn't go to college so you could carry people's luggage," Jackie said, not sniping necessarily, but simply telling him the truth. "You don't even need a high school diploma to do this job." Hearing her say this, over and over, her jaw set and thrust forward, her tone objectively observant, was the reason he found himself coming around Chapman Street less and less often since Continental had hired him. At first he'd replied aggressively with various versions of, "I'm the one trying to make ends meet around here, and that wasn't going to happen on a teacher's salary." And these exchanges became real arguments, the kind that flushed their faces with blood and urged them harder and deeper into one another's weakest points. Her debating points were logical and immediate. He was a Yale graduate, a scientist, a teacher, one who had benefited from the sacrifices of others. So what the hell was he doing working the lowest-level job in the entire airport? His were more abstract. He had a plan that one day would make sense to her. And in the meantime, he was a grown man who had the right to make his own decisions. Decisions, he was quick to remind her, that had historically turned out well. Then there were the wages, the benefits, the liberation of his mind that the manual labor allowed. In essence, he'd swapped mental wear and tear for physical. When he was a kid, before St. Benedict's or Yale, an airline job would have been seen as a solid career path, as it was for his cousin Nathan. In his evolving view, the fact that he'd gone to those schools and accomplished those things didn't need to complicate what life had once been about, the simplicity of providing for oneself without expectations. At a certain point, he couldn't explain these feelings to his mother. They came off as defensive, which was a platform Rob hated to stand on. When her son left, Jackie would sit on the front porch, stewing and chain-smoking in the dusky summer light. Her frustration had little to do with disappointment, but rather with fear. She was afraid for her headstrong son, because no matter how articulately Rob spun his circumstances, she knew what almost 40 years of manual labor felt like, terrible, and what it earned you, very little. Her son seemed to be belatedly rebelling against all his celebrated accomplishments, as well as the responsibilities inherent in them, the obligation to his own talent. In that rebellion, she saw a young man who was confused and upset that his life wasn't stacking up to be what he and everyone around him had always assumed it would. In short, she saw a weakness. Rob's extreme and not always coherent argumentativeness, which deployed in force whenever she brought the subject up, supported her view. His whole life he'd listened to her, whether she was complaining about work or pressing through the tricky economics of paying for high school. By listening in his gentle way, he'd made things okay. He'd been her sounding board, her life partner, her heart. Now, at age 27, when he should have been thinking about starting his own family, he was sassing her like a child. Whatever future he saw for himself right now, however vividly he saw that future, its images lay beyond the reach of her bewildered eyes, even if those eyes were literally and figuratively short-sighted. Jackie was almost 60 years old. Though she had never known about Rob's second job, she might have found some solace in the fact that, as he'd done during his last career shift at St. Benedict's, he'd stopped selling drugs for the moment. In addition to being able to give out buddy passes, Continental employees themselves flew for free on standby, a fundamental component of Rob's short-term plan. He had gotten a job through Nathan, who worked in the control tower as a kind of runway manager, tracking incoming planes and moving the tarmac workers around from gate to gate to accommodate them. Nathan and Rob had recently traveled to Amsterdam together. During that week of excess, Rob had learned that as long as employees logged their monthly quota of 160 hours worked, they could go anywhere at any time. No longer did Rob have to wait for national holidays to make his sorties to Chicago and Orlando to prospect properties. No longer did he have to hustle in order to afford the tickets. The airline had thousands of employees at Newark International, and the supervisors were generally bottom-line types. The attitude was, get your work done, doesn't matter how. Weeknight shifts were preferred because there was less runway traffic and the air was cooler, so it was relatively easy for Rob to trade nights for days and weekends, transactions he treated like any other form of dealing. He front-loaded his months with double and even triple shifts, so that he could clear space to travel and to further the cause of Peace Realty. By the end of his first summer working for Continental, he had narrowed his target neighborhoods down to 3 in Cleveland and 2 in South Florida. A $10,000 down payment on a property there would require a monthly mortgage payment of roughly $400. If he could pin down 4 houses, he would be paying a total of $1,600 each month, which was only marginally more than the house on Greenwood Avenue was bringing in. The challenge was to find properties in relatively good condition so that the renovations wouldn't put him underwater. I don't need to be replacing no more damn boilers, he said to Tavris. He'd known that these stipulations would be harder than they sounded, but he didn't know how hard they would actually be. Most of the available properties Rob could afford had suffered some form of neglect. Even for a middle-class family with steady factory income in Ohio, avoiding maintenance costs was always easier than addressing them. And by the time the family had saved up enough to pay for a major repair, they were probably in a position to move to a better neighborhood anyway. What they left behind were shorted out lumps of electrical wires stapled into the crawl spaces, rot, rodent and insect infestations, cracked foundations, asbestos and radon and mold, water damage. Rob would spend 4-day weekends going from house to house, crouching in the crawl spaces with a flashlight to look at water pipes and gas lines, swearing at the rats. At night, he would mutter on the phone to friends, "How is it possible that not a single fucking person in America knows how to respect a goddamn house?" And on the rare occasion when he did find an ideal property, he would lose it to the competition. Real estate prospectors with the exact same idea, who had the benefit of operating locally and with far more liquid cash to invest. At the end of these trips, he would disembark at Newark International, pull his small rolling suitcase through the terminals, and try to ignore the families of hyped-up children leaving for summer vacation. the businessmen in suits, walking very fast while thumbing their cell phones, the students with gigantic canvas duffels heading off to college. Often he would just go straight to work, with 2 weeks of 16-hour days ahead of him to make up for the fruitless ventures. "It's frustrating as hell," he said in the kitchen at 34 Smith Street in early September. He'd just come home from the airport. Flowey, Curtis, and Tavris were there, smoking, having the first drinks of the evening over aluminum containers of chicken wings. The first thing Rob did was crack his joints, the full length of his body, while his friends cringed, rat-tat-tat-tat, endlessly, impossibly, grossly realigning his diarthroidal joints. Then he poured himself a tall vodka with cranberry juice, sat at the table, and took his boots off. "Well, shit, you thought it would be easy building an empire?" Flowey asked. Rob shook his head and exhaled. "Just didn't think it would take this long." Rob hadn't discussed the move to Continental with his friends. He hadn't discussed many decisions at all since he'd taken the St. Benedict's job 4 years ago. "Anyway, fuck it," he said, meaning, "let's talk about something else." Tavris had a son now, named Christopher, who was a year old. The mother was his girlfriend, Darlene. Their living situation was precarious at the moment, crammed into a small one-bedroom in the North Ward of Newark. The baby had been accidental, and they had no plans to get married, but they were both working and seemed happy, above the line of self-sufficiency for the moment. When their own personal topics became grim or redundant, the friends talked about that. The first child born among the Burger Boys, and a boy, no less. Flowey had been with his girlfriend, LaQuisha, for 6 years, but they'd been careful about contraception. His foremost reasoning for choosing St. Benedict's had been to avoid getting someone pregnant. Childbirth and education were more or less mutually exclusive in the neighborhood where he'd grown up. Now that his education was over, Flowey thought of fatherhood in terms of leaving the hood. He'd seen babies become anchors among many of his friends. The new costs paired with the necessity for proximate family child care rendered moving even a few miles away impossible. Tavris's situation served as a prime example. Flowey didn't even know how he was going to move, but he talked about it often, the dream of getting out of Essex County and settling down someplace where there was space, trees, and no gangs. The problem was that in places like that, there were no jobs, at least not for him. There were enough indoor and outdoor pools in Newark for him to be lifeguarding most of the time, and the job required more than CPR training. He also had to keep gang fights from breaking out, using skills he'd developed growing up. Where neighborhoods were more spread out and the pools belonged to country clubs, this particular job qualification didn't help him, nor did the dozen-plus tattoos he now wore, many of them the result of tattoo parties he sometimes hosted. Matthew chapter 20, verse 7, Psalms 23, and numerous tributes to friends he'd lost. Curtis's marketing job was secure but promised no upward mobility, and being beholden to corporate types had been grating on him for 2 years now. In high school and college, he'd been the dynamic center of his social circles, the person others looked to when they wanted to know where to go. He'd always been in motion, planning the nights, planning the weekends, planning the future. Now he worked on a team of public relations people, servicing energy companies, which seemed pointless to him since energy was an inelastic demand and thus had no real need to be promoted. He'd lived in a condo in South Orange for a few years, but had ultimately moved back to Smith Street when his mother had moved away. After more than 30 years there, the neighborhood had come to feel too dangerous for her. The house was fully owned, and the economics made enough sense to justify the more precarious environment. He didn't know what his next job should be, just that he was gaining weight, both physically and mentally, in his current job. They talked in and around these subjects, but mostly they talked about other things, such as their high school years and how theirs had been the best class in the history of St. Benedict's. They had a good night. Each of them felt his various pressures easing off, as always happened, when they were sitting at this table in this house. Their shared stories, their verbal shorthand, the non-judgment that was the rule, and the feeling of total seclusion from whatever was going on outside these walls. Though they had congregated at this table less often as the years rolled by, the feeling it gave was vital, knowing that on a random weeknight like this, one or all of them would always be here to download. The blunt came around to Rob, and he passed. "You're really still worried about that?" Curtis asked. He was referring to the random urine tests at Continental. Rob hadn't smoked since before he started working at the airline, and that helped explain why he'd been so uncharacteristically short-tempered. He'd given up his most effective outlet for stress. could no longer release it from his chest alongside artful plumes of smoke. Come on, man, no one's going to test you. It's just to keep you scared. They've tested people, Rob said. It's real. We're talking about airplanes, big ones, lots of them. You think they fuck around with that? Actually, his friends had been floored when Rob quit smoking marijuana, even more so than they were when he stopped dealing. Rob Peace, who had smoked practically every day since high school, had quit cold turkey. And he'd done so almost imperceptibly, just passing joints and blunts and bowls along when they came to him, saying quietly, I'm good, or I already had, or heading to my ma's house in a few. This meant that he was beyond serious about real estate and the job that allowed him to pursue it. This was not a whim or a stopgap. This was what he wanted to do. Even when he sounded as he had tonight, pissed off and slightly helpless about repeated setbacks, they didn't worry. For as long as they'd known him, Rod Peace had always achieved what he'd wanted. In the fall of 2007, just as Rob began to feel that he'd gotten a sense of the hidden intricacies of the real estate market, that when the right property came up, he'd have the wherewithal to get in first with confidence, the housing bubble burst in earnest. Plummeting prices and the mass offloading of property should have been a stroke of luck in the arena in which Rob was trying to operate. In theory, he would be able to grab up the properties even cheaper than they already were, and then wait for the rebound. But along with the fall in prices came the breakdown of the subprime lenders market. And Rob, whose whole business plan hinged on being a good subprime lending candidate himself, learned gradually over the course of the fall that even if he were to find one or more properties that fit his designs, there wouldn't be any money available to him. For the foreseeable future, the holdings of Peace Realty would be limited to one property at 122 Greenwood Avenue, and Rob would be using his free flight benefits less for business and more to travel the world. We talked two or three times that year. These conversations were typically brief. My soft-spoken, halting voice did not lend itself to cell phones. Damn, why can't you speak up? He said more than once. I'm trying, I replied. Can you hear me now? He laughed. You sound like a mouse, same as you did in college. He talked about all the traveling he'd been doing, Rio again, South Korea, and an aim to visit Croatia soon. But he never told me that the reason he was able to do this was that he worked in the luggage department of an airline. I told him about the release of my novel the previous spring, right around Rob's departure from St. Benedict's. Yeah, yeah, he said. I heard that some magazine was comparing you to The Great Gatsby or some shit. That might have been a stretch, I said. Look at you, to Jeffrey, my boy, all famous now. I just laughed, and as he'd withheld the specific nature of his employment from me, so, too, did I avoid informing him that this novel had sold only a few thousand copies, that my second novel had failed to sell to a publisher on the first go-round, and that, while working insecurely on a third, I was copy-editing self-published self-help books in order to pay our rent in Los Angeles. I didn't tell him anything about my life that would suggest I was doing anything other than what I'd always aspired to do. As far as either of us knew, at the end of these calls, we were both all good and always had been. I asked about Katrina, the girl he'd brought to my wedding. The psh sound he made told me what direction that had gone in. He asked about Rebecca, and I said she was fine. She knocked up yet? No, but we're psyched to start a family. We're trying. We'd been trying for 2 years, in fact, and Rebecca had had three miscarriages. I didn't feel comfortable revealing those troubles either. He laughed. Good luck with all that. Trying's the fun part, from what I've heard. We ventured no further. The distance between us and the maleness of our friendship precluded revealing anything that truly mattered, and at the time I was too naive to know that if you were friends with someone, truly friends, then you told them what was going on. It's called catching up, my wife informed me when I asked how it was possible for her to yap with her girlfriends for as long as she did and share every innocuous detail of her life. Instead, I thought that by concisely presenting the most easygoing and put-together version of myself, I was being all good. Really, I was just fronting. And Rob was doing the same. I'm starting to fucking hate you. Nah, I didn't say that. I didn't say I fucking hate you. I said, I'm starting to fucking hate you. Victor and Big Steve looked at each other for a moment, then both of them began hysterically laughing. Rob pinched the phone between his cheek and shoulder in order to raise his arms and give them a helpless, exasperated look, and he mouthed, I can't believe this bitch. They were in the small house Victor and Steve shared in Brown's Mills, a little over an hour south of Newark. Rob had come to spend the night. Then a girlfriend of his, whom he referred to only as Philly, where she lived, called and hassled him about not telling her where he was. The conversation had escalated, as his conversations with women often did. Female shit, which was what he called pretty much everything women did or said, was one of the few things he had no patience for. Thug love, Victor said after Rob finally got off. That's what I'm going to start calling you. And indeed, that night, Victor changed Rob's contact name in his cell phone from Sean to Thug Love. His close friends had always been flummoxed by Rob's approach to romantic relationships. He loved women, and he had little trouble getting them to love him. His tell-it-like-it-is approach to humor, for whatever reason, was attractive. You're just mad because I'm prettier than you, he'd once said to a girl giving him attitude outside an East Orange bar. A few minutes later, he came away with her number. But once a relationship started, all he did was complain and provoke. He would say he was going to be somewhere, and then he would be somewhere else, and when the irritated call came, he would feign ignorance and improvise creative new ways to make the problem her own fault. Rarely did his friends meet the women with whom he was involved. To parties, he would bring other girls, often unattractive ones, what his friends termed busted, whom he cared nothing about. Not many nights passed without a phone call that he would take into the next room while Curtis, Victor, True, whatever guys he preferred to hang out with over his girlfriends, overheard him progress through the beats of the same self-wrought arguments, almost as if following a script. Typically, these had to do with time, his lack of it, his inability to respect it. When the relationships ended, as they invariably did, his friends would crack that the girl in question had been robbed. Victor traced this pattern back to Zena, his freshman year girlfriend at Yale. Before she'd broken his heart, Rob had always been shy and hesitant around girls. Afterward, almost instantly, he'd become bold, crass, and too often mean. "Why do you do this to yourself, man?" Curtis asked him after a particularly vitriolic phone spat with a woman Rob called Lawyer Girl. "I mean, damn. When we're together, it's cool, but when we're not together, she goes crazy. So bring her over here sometime." "Nah, you do not want to see what this looks like in person." Curtis laughed. Never did his best friend seem so helpless, so not in control as he did when a girlfriend called to chew him out. But he was also concerned. He didn't know anyone else who was better equipped to care for women. Rob had his mother and grandmother, of course, whom he doted on religiously even when they'd been fighting about his airline job. He checked in on Raquel Diaz and Daniela Pierce often and listened to their problems with attentive thought, if not always with patience. Shannon Higgins, his junior high girlfriend, who was now raising a daughter alone, relied on him to bring dinner to her apartment multiple times a week. He had cousins, neighbors, former classmates, so many others whom he took care of devoutly. The fact that Rob could spend so many of his waking hours, the majority, it sometimes seemed, tending to the women in his life, and yet he couldn't get through one phone call with a serious girlfriend that didn't bring him to profane heights of frustration, was bewildering. Both his male and female friends egged him on in this regard. They found no end of amusement in seeing Rob Peace, the man, reduced to a stammering, flailing, one-dimensional sitcom character. And yet they also believed this repetitive play-acting embodied a greater struggle inside him, one he refused to discuss. The fact was, he seemed positively determined to stave off anything resembling a functional personal relationship until he reached a place where he could take care of Jackie. And in the fall of 2008, with the housing market stalled and Rob's savings drained once again, that place lay farther and farther away. "The only thing that will save you," Raquel had told him in her apartment one night, "is a good woman." Rob sipped his Hennessy and smiled, though not the grin she expected, and one that both absorbed and deflected. This smile was fainter, almost wistful. "Girl," he said, "at this point, I wouldn't know what to do with a good woman, even if I found one." Raquel's belly was round and her skin glowed. 6 months earlier, a two-day bender had found her in the bathroom of a friend's apartment on the Upper West Side, peering into a mirror as blood crept from both her nostrils. Her friends were all asleep, and she had scraped up the dregs of the party powder, trying to figure out how she might cram another spoonful of cocaine up past the source of the bleeding, thinking, "If you're going to do this, then you have to watch yourself do this." She did watch herself, then stemmed the blood flow with toilet paper and continued. At 4 or 5 that morning in a cab on the way back to East 119th Street, it occurred to her through the haze that she could conceivably have died at some point during the last 48 hours. Simon was sitting calmly on their futon. By now, the home renovations were finished, and their apartment was modern and roomy. He hadn't heard from her the whole time she'd been out. She started weeping in front of him, certain that he was about to tell her to leave both the room and his life. Instead, he said in his calm,